Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, this is the time of year that at 4 in the morning, the Great Bear is standing on the end of its tail and filling up the front windows of our home. I'm getting in a couple camping days this week, and maybe some more interviews for you too. Well, those two new Desert Oracle radio episodes got released this week, so today I'm bringing you the one from August 31st, 2024. Ken calls it Ghost Riders and Death Valley Rangers. It includes a bit of Bible trivia, a story about Stan Jones, and a loving comment about dogs. After that, you'll hear the rest of my interview with Zach Shattuck from Montana FWP. For now, get comfortable and listen up.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, the brief false autumn, all gone now. Those blessed early cool nights after the usual slog of summer. But there's still another month of desert summertime according to the official calendar. And one mild week does not an autumn make. But it was beautiful for those couple of days and nights, all the windows open on the west side anyway, the shady side. Nothing like a pleasant breeze while the coffee maker burbles. Well, here's an important update if anybody's keeping track. The raven with the strange voice, the one I call Weird Annie. Well, there are several more of her kind all grown up now, and they've inherited that same distinctive call. So a Joshua tree full of these particular large black corvids means a whole chorus of Weird Annie's back-asswards raven call. Unnatural selection, nature's joker. Yeah, they're all just like her, constantly outraged, hopping up and down, absolutely zero chill, utterly indifferent to me, even when I walk right up to the tree holding my phone up. Talk into this, how's it going, Weird Annie? I see you got your whole brood over here. Nothing. Snow flurries in the Sierra, monsoon floods in Moab, tourists washed away by the swollen creeks, always an exciting time. When the monsoons swell up and Las Vegas quits clocking consecutive 100-degree-plus days. So be careful out there. Or not. It's not my responsibility. Let's open up the Bible. I can't save the tourist and I can't save your soul, but I can open the Bible. Thank you. If you went to Sunday school or Bible study or whatever they call it, depending on the franchise, well, you probably remember that somewhere along the way, Jesus asked you to consider the lilies and also the sparrows. But only real gospel heads will recall that in both cases, Jesus illustrates that in nature, species thrive without anybody taking care of them, because they are of the kingdom of God. Well, this is from Matthew's version, 6:28 and 29. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to your span of life? But in Luke's version, it gets darker. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, and have neither storehouse nor barn. And God feeds them. Now that version is a very old saying. It was old when Jesus was born. Some everyday wisdom that you would have heard in the time after the seven sages of ancient Greece. Truth known to everyone who ever fought upon, died upon, or picked over a battlefield. Deus pascit corvos. God feeds the ravens. That is the Latin motto on a number of medieval coats of arms. Sometimes as a threat. The gods will feed the ravens on the flesh of our enemies, and sometimes as a providential sort of joke, as in the heraldry of many families with a surname meaning raven. Corbeau, Corbett, Guervo, Krasinski, Rambo. That latter surname is Swedish-Norwegian. Sounds like a movie character, doesn't it?
Desert Oracle Radio.
I saw the writer Nina Antonia. Nina Antonia? I don't know how it's pronounced. She was talking about the classic Cowboys song, Ghost Riders in the Sky, and how it reminded her of the Wild Hunt. I thought about that too, most recently when the Johnny Cash version was playing on the satellite radio Outlaw Country Station. I thought about the red-eyed hairy monsters in so many folkloric tales too, in America and everywhere else. But the song Ghost Riders in the Sky is about a cowboy resting up on a ridge when he spies a dreadful ghostly cattle drive across the dark sky. Their brands were still on fire, and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. That songwriter, Stan Jones, born in Douglas, Arizona in 1914, said once that an old cowpoke had told him the fable years prior. Most cowboy songs are about riding the range, missing your sweetheart, wishing for cool water, gunfights and gun smoke, etc. But there's a subset of religious vision songs. Marty Robbins' frantic The Master's Call from his Gunfighter Ballads album is another one. But it's Ghost Riders in the Sky that's best known to us today when it comes to terrifying visions in nature that cause a person to turn their life around. Maybe that old cowpoke story really had come down from the old wild hunt tales from Northern Europe. These are the stories often reported as true events that left the witnesses badly shaken and occasionally beaten. Of Woden charging across the night sky on his sled pulled by various fire-snorting beasts, in pursuit of equally hellish spirit animals going across the sky. Sometimes, as with the terrifying host of the air in the Hebrides Islands, the mortal can be swept up into this fury, levitated, and even carried for miles. Returned, perhaps, when the hosts of the air get tired of you. Cattle and sheep were most often the victims, found later in curious poses, dropped from high above, the corpses broken, the blood gone. Such things happen even in our own era, now and then, our own era of Mythbusters and Ring cameras and boredom. Livestock mutilation, that's what they call it these days, and the kids like to blame it on alien spaceships or heavy metal rock and roll, a style last popular with the kids some 40 years ago. Stan Jones wrote dozens of songs that charted over the decades and some very memorable film music, such as the theme from John Ford's Western classic, The Searchers. And Stan acted in plenty of Westerns for both the big screen and television. While visiting his mother over the Christmas holidays in December 1955, he was interviewed by the Petaluma Argus Courier and asked about his interesting career progression. Because Stan Jones was a real cowboy and a real ranger, he lived a life of grand adventure. Because that's how he made his living. Former Petaluman home for the holidays was the headline on Christmas Eve of that year, and I'll read a couple lines from the newspaper archive. The day Stan Jones was born, Pancho Villa was shelling a Mexican town a few yards across the border from Jones's parents' ranch at Douglas, Arizona. When Stan Jones was a small boy, he knew Pancho and many another famous Western hero and villain as he grew up. Adventure remained his partner as a kid cowpuncher on the family ranch, rodeo circuit rider, U.S. Navy sailor, and a logger in the Pacific Northwest. The logging job nearly cost him his life when a work train crashed in a tunnel, killing three other workmen. Stanley Jones survived. Eventually, he came back to California to finish school at UC Berkeley. Then he became a ranger, first in the U.S. Forest Service, and then in the National Park Service. I tell you, reading newspaper features on people from a century ago is a good way to realize just how soft and dumb we've all become. Stan Jones wrote songs purely for himself, figuring he penned thousands of verses over the years, but he kept his poetry to himself. People liked to see cowboys sing in motion pictures or hear them on the radio in those days, but not so much in real life. Even if they were real-life cowboys. Jones told the paper, "It seems silly, I know, but it was a rough life in those days and rough country, and I wasn't about to let anyone know I wrote songs." But sometime in 1948 or 49, when Ranger Jones was on the job in Death Valley National Monument, he remembered the fable of the ghost riders and wrote it down in song, put it to a haunting, memorable melody. Not long after, the park superintendent assigned Ranger Jones to show some Western movie location scouts around the harsh desert landscape. And Ranger Jones wound up singing Ghost Riders in the Sky to these guys as an example of cowboy campfire music, his own. They liked it. And they liked Stanley Jones. He was promptly hired as a technical advisor on the picture, which was called The Walking Hills. The Petaluma newspaper continues, "Jones made a half dozen motion pictures and wrote four television shows. At least 11 million record sales bear testimony to his prowess as a composer. Recently, he portrayed a camp counselor in Spinnin' Marty on Disney's new daily TV show, The Mickey Mouse Club, on ABC. I wonder how that Mickey Mouse Club worked out." Jones's last movie role was in Ten Who Dared, the Buena Vista production released in 1960. He played Seneca Howland, one of the Daring Ten on John Wesley Powell's famous exploration of the Colorado River, which was filmed on location in the Grand Canyon. Not a great movie, considered one of the worst Disney Westerns, but it must have been great fun to replicate Major Powell's wild adventure down the Colorado. What a life. And people are still listening to his songs today, still appreciating the movies he made. Except for that last one, I guess. And people are still talking about his songs and what these songs might mean on the internet in 2024. Stanley Jones was just 49 years old when he died in 1963 in Los Angeles. He is buried at Calvary Memorial Park in Cochise County, Arizona, right near his birthplace in Douglas. And the soundscapes for this movie are composed and performed by our own Ranger Jones, red, blue, black, silver.
I am silver!
Walking a trail out by the power lines, I catch my dog eating the wing of a long dead bird. And a mile later, he's chomping on a big sun-bleached bone from an animal unknown. And later that night, when I give him his good, healthy dinner, he glares up at me because there's not enough turkey meat. For his taste, I suppose. The kibble's a little dry. Incredible nerve. Pure gall. Dog number 7, I think. Including the childhood dogs, I remember. Not a purebred among them until my parents decided later in their lives to get a Pomeranian. And when my dad passed on, 3 decades ago now, well, that dog wound up living with me in San Francisco in a third floor apartment at Bush and Leavenworth, big round bay window on the corner, looking out on the chaos and beauty below. I figured out that my dad enjoyed taking Rusty the Pomeranian to saloons, to bar rooms. Because whenever I'd walk by one, the dog would just head in. And there were still a lot of saloons in what the maps call Lower Knob Hill and everybody else called the Tender Knob, right between the hill and the loin. After work, editing eye surgery monographs for the Academy of Ophthalmology across from the Buena Vista by the Hyde Street Pier, I'd walk up and over Russian Hill, get home and get the dog. We'd stroll around down to Polk Gulch, over to Grace Cathedral, and that dog would come to a complete stop at every set of swinging doors, sniffing the beer air, listening to the jukebox, straining on the leash to get inside. Sometimes I'd pick him up and we'd go in where he'd settle on a bar stool next to me and I'd have an anchor steam or maybe an Irish coffee, and even the grumbliest old working man deep into his 5th or 6th beer would be charmed by this little dog and his quiet but curious personality. Give a man a few drinks and show him a good dog, and it's a doorway to the past. Memories of childhood, of hunting and fishing trips, of marriages happy and sad, children grown up and gone, fortunes won and lost. The Pomeranian, I learned in time, is really the German Spitz, bred down in size from the original Teutonic Knight's working dog, in large part because England's Queen Victoria had a pair of very popular toy Pomeranians later in her reign. The Wolfspitz was the working dog of Teutonic Prussia in the coastal north of modern-day Poland and eastern Germany. They are mentioned in Teutonic Order documents going back to 1450, which explains, I believe, why these little dog descendants of Pomerania are so bold and brave. In their ancestral memory, ever present in mind, they are 50-pound dogs regularly employed by shepherd and warrior, bred for the cold, cold winters, hardy and hale. There are some parts of life we measure in generations. Raising your children, silver anniversaries, 20 years of schooling, and they put you on the day shift, etc. And there are some parts we measure in our domestic animals and dogs. A tighter time frame, 10 or 12 years, a sort of sundial for your lifespan. When you've lived past 7 or 8 dogs in a row, get your affairs in order. Amboy to Zyzix, broadcasting across the great Mojave Wilderness and around the world through the magic of podcasting. This is Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. This program comes to you from the Santa Minerva Radio Information Network. Visit our website at desertoracle.com. And thank you to our supporters who keep this show alive through their patronage at patreon.com/Desert Oracle. Listen up, friends, if you're in Santa Fe, I'm going to be bumming around town later this week. This first Thursday and Friday evening of September, it looks like. Nothing official, purely personal. But I met some interesting people last time I did a show in Santa Fe. Speaking of park rangers. And I'd be glad to meet up with a couple of you, if you're still around at some watering hole or another, either of those nights. And if it's too loud, well, we can just walk around the plaza between bar stops. Beautiful time of year for that. Looks like it's going to be about, low 50s Fahrenheit. Send me a message on the pneumatic tube system, whatever we have going. And I want to say hello to our friend and listener, John Greismer in New Hampshire. He says, as far as I can tell, I'm the only guy in New Hampshire with a Desert Oracle sticker on his pickup. Thank you for sending this postcard in reference to our Betty and Barney Hill episode from the beginning of this year. And the postcard has a picture of the historical plaque. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Let's continue hearing that interview I began last week with, I think, the most enthusiastic pallid sturgeon expert I've ever met, Zach Shattuck. We left off last week talking about the pallid sturgeons, their lives and their range.
You may have already covered this, but has that count changed through the years up to the present day?
Yeah, and I don't know if there's necessarily a population kind of abundance that anybody could suggest, you know, for the 1900s to now. You know, a lot of the pallid sturgeon that we saw in Montana, you know, ended up being captured because we were doing early surveys either in the kind of the river prior to Fort Peck Dam being constructed or Garrison Dam being constructed, and then immediately afterwards. So you had a bunch of big old fish that were essentially trapped in some of these reservoir reaches. And that's where we started to really see these big fish. There's historical photos, you know, from the 50s of, you know, folks in Williston, North Dakota, with a couple of, you know, big old sturgeon that were, you know, probably a meter and a half, you know, long. They, I mean, big fish that probably weighed, you know, 50, 60 pounds. And those were the kind of remaining adults that got, you know, kind of trapped between some of these reaches. So you've now got essentially two populations in Montana. You've got, you know, those that are upstream of Fort Peck Dam to the Great Falls. And then you've got those that are upstream at Garrison Dam, North Dakota, that live in that sort of Yellowstone, Missouri River confluence area and move up to Fort Peck Dam on the Missouri and then upwards towards kind of like Cartersville, diversion dam towards Forsyth in Montana on the Yellowstone.
Okay. And are there any current efforts to protect or restore the species?
Yeah. And so, and I now that I'm remembering, for as far as population abundance, there's really very, very few remaining wild adults left in the Missouri River upstream of Fort Peck Dam, handful. In the Missouri River and the Yellowstone River, downstream of Fort Peck Dam and into North Dakota, Montana, you know, there's probably, you know, somewhere less than, you know, 50, 60 wild individuals left. You know, because this species was listed under an Endangered Species Act in 1990, the first kind of priority was to, you know, capture the available genetics for the population. So a number of fish were brought to the hatchery, you know, to spawn there, you know, Garrison National Fish Hatchery, that Miles City State Fish Hatchery, Gavin's Point National Fish Hatchery. And this is where really the species was saved from extinction. So because of those efforts, we were able to capture, you know, the maximum sort of extent of available genetics and start to make, you know, kind of unique crosses in male, female of these fish to, you know, ensure that they were not going to contribute to inbreeding in the population and maximize, you know, how those genetics are realized at that population level. So in 1990, fish is listed, these efforts go on. And then in 1997 is really the first year that we stocked those fish that have been produced in the hatchery into the river. Those fish, you know, being a kind of a sturgeon biologist is really, for the most part, just a waiting game. So those 97 individuals from, you know, from 1997 are really only just now in the last five or so years become sexually mature and are now at a point where we can kind of learn something from those fish on how they might respond, you know, to some of these, you know, altered environments and, you know, where they might go to spawn, how frequently they would spawn. And yeah, so now things are that biologists generations before us have queued up. We're just now getting to the questions that they had, you know, from the get-go. So it, you know, as far as those kind of counts and where we're at with abundance, very few wild fish. We've got a good number of hatchery-reared fish, and that is really kind of a deceptive number. I mean, we've got thousands and thousands of hatchery fish in the river, and that's a good thing. So people are starting to see these fish more often because there's a good number of them in the river, but that is to essentially secure that population, you know, through time, because those are the last of the genetics for that fish species. And just because we have a number of them in the river does not in any way, shape, or form mean that fish is recovered. This is really kind of, you know, to ensure they don't go extinct. And those are two different things.
So is there a way that outdoor recreationalists can help in the effort to protect them or preserve them?
Absolutely. I think, and that's something that I think people end up getting interested in. And with sturgeon, it's an interesting fish species to work with because it's inherently not as visible as, say, a trout species. You can't be on a hike and look down in a creek and see, bull trout or West Slope cutthroat trout. You go to the Missouri River, and a functioning, healthy Missouri River means you can't see into the water. It's just mud. And from that standpoint, it's oftentimes hard to inspire, the charisma of that fish species and to really, promote and educate it because, folks just can't see it. And so our fish biologists have really done a good job of kind of, trying to understand that and bringing the fish to people. And so if there's a few places in the country you can go see, pallid sturgeon in an aquarium, one of them's right here in Helena, there at Montana Wild. There's a couple places in Nebraska and Missouri, but really it comes to being able to show what these fish species look like kind of on the river and a lot of the sampling that we do. And so I wanted to kind of just briefly go back and what efforts are being done. There has been a ton of work on pallid sturgeon. A couple of projects that are relatively famous in Montana, one of them being efforts to provide fish passage at Intake Diversion Dam on the Yellowstone. That was a very big project, and we've got right away a lot of success in that project. We've seen adults pass using the bypass channel the last several years. We've had hatchery reared and wild individuals move all the way up the Powder River all the way into Wyoming. This is the first time pallid sturgeon have ever been documented in Wyoming. And we've seen that 2 years in a row. So that was, there's not very many instances in a biologist's kind of career where they can kind of hang their hat on some of those firsts. And then we've got, pallid sturgeon moving up in the Tongue and then further up in the Yellowstone River. And this is a good thing. This is, increasing that footprint of available drift distance. And we've got some exciting things going on. And then on the Missouri side, this past spring, the Army Corps of Engineers had conducted an experimental release of flows to kind of cue up pallid sturgeon and move them upstream. We did see some response from pallid sturgeon in adults, getting that pulse of water and moving upstream. Those fish had been, really well watched for the summer, weren't sure, what was going to happen. And then, about mid-July, we got notice that a female that, had been captured a couple weeks prior was suddenly, a kilo light, and it was confirmed that that fish did spawn in the Missouri River, right down by, I think, just upstream of Wolf Point. So that was a very exciting kind of thing that we had a wild reproducing fish on the Missouri. We haven't seen that really since 2011 in the Missouri that far up. We typically see that population really spawning down low, in the sort of Sydney reach of the Yellowstone River. So there's a lot of research that is on the, been conducted for pallid sturgeon on the river. We've got biologists that you'll see them probably every day of the week out there tracking fish. We use, little radio tags that we insert surgically into the fish, and that allows us to, use an antenna and track them around the river and be able to, locate those fish and understand some of those movements, both, kind of seasonally. And then, during reproductive periods, maybe where they might be honing in on as far as spawning habitat and the hatcheries and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's an immense amount of, I mean, we could spend days talking about the amount of work that's been done on these fish. And I will tell you this, though, we're in a good spot.
Good. That is so encouraging. That's so great. If someone caught one of these species, should they report it to you, or do they know they should report it?
So if someone catches sees a species, really what I like to tell anybody anywhere that if you don't know what it is, let it go. So if you don't know, let it go. Pretty easy little mantra. We want our anglers to kind of repeat that, know that, really pick up a copy of our fishing regs, for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. There in the very back, the last page, there's a sort of an identification, sort of easy to kind of navigate between shovelnose and pallid. So with those two species, with pallid sturgeon, it's an endangered fish. Absolutely. You know, that fish needs to be treated with great care, released immediately. But what a lot of anglers don't understand is that any sturgeon over 40 inches needs to be treated the same way. So if you have a shovel nose that's over 40 inches, that fish needs to be released immediately. And this is really, you know, to protect those old, reproductively active pallid sturgeon, and just sort of bank on that. Maybe people don't know how to identify between the two, but really the safe bet is to ensure that you know what you have, and if you don't, to let it go, because there are stiff penalties and fines for harvesting a pallid sturgeon. And what's more is that to harvest a pallid sturgeon is really doing a disservice to the recovery efforts to that species. And there's a ton of effort that goes into, you know, really understanding each and every one of these individuals. Most of these fish we know, you know, probably on a first name basis. There aren't that many. And so when people take one of those individuals out, that's a huge loss, you know, for the recovery program. All the things that we've, you know, known about that fish species to date, all the things that we could have known, you know, had that angler, you know, just used a little more caution and release that fish. So yeah, if you catch that fish species, consider yourself pretty lucky. That's a rare fish. You know, take a kind of quick mental image. Maybe if it's appropriate and that fish is in the water and doing fine, take a quick image and then let it go. If you want to say, hey, you know, I caught this fish here, released it, and let a biologist know, I bet they'd love that. You know, a lot of people, I think, sometimes are intimidated to talk to our fish biologists on the river. They have got, they're just like me. They've got a just a bottleneck of information that they're waiting to just spring on some poor unsuspecting angler that just fire hose them with information. But no, the best bet is just if you don't know, let it go. And yeah, just enjoy being on the river. I think the thing about sturgeon is that they are generalist species as far as their kind of prey. And if you're fishing for channel catfish or you're fishing for walleye or smallmouth bass, you might be using the very same things that, you know, you could catch a sturgeon with. So be prepared that, you know, you might run into a pallid sturgeon and know what those fish look like, you know, before you get out on the river.
Good advice. And can you give any advice to someone that would like to do what you do for a living, like courses of study, volunteer work, or other ways to learn more?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, if you're at all interested, you know, in being a fish biologist, being a fish technician, just getting into this field, I would say, you know, talk to folks in your area, in your community. There's fish biologists that live all across the state and, you know, well beyond. Fish biologists are in every state, you know, in the country. And it's a kind of quirky bunch. And if somebody shows just a smidgen of interest in what they do, I promise you, they will be more than happy to talk to you and, you know, kind of walk you through their perspective on how they got to where they're at. For me, this was something that I feel like just been born with. This was a job that I was aware of at a young age. You know, my dad was always wanting to go fishing with me. My uncle was a fish biologist, and so this was something that I knew existed, and I went to college knowing exactly what I wanted to study. There is kind of a formal step to it. I mean, I think for a lot of what we do, there's a very technical, scientific aspect of it that requires, you know, a bit of education. But I think the most important part of that, you know, there are people that get those degrees and don't do much of anything. I think the important part is to get out there, go, you know, find out what graduate students' projects are going on and work on those projects. Go, you know, talk to your local biologist. Go, you know, maybe work for a nonprofit and, you know, kind of get an idea of what you want to do, because even within this very slim kind of career, there's a lot of, you know, diversity in kind of what folks do. And there are some things that people like and some things people don't like. But I think it's important to get a realistic, you know, depiction of what it is to be a fish biologist. Some people, you know, get the sense that all we're doing is just fishing and hanging out on boats, and that's not always the case. We do get to do a lot of cool things in our job, but you know, there's a lot that, you know, takes a great amount of effort and work. And then probably the lesser known aspect of it is there's a lot of heartbreak that comes with being a fish biologist, particularly a fish biologist that works with an endangered fish. You know, there's a lot of successes that can be had, but sometimes, you're sort of faced with a lot of disappointment and how you deal with that and how you kind of keep pushing, in the interests of that fish species or the resource so that, those are the things that I think you need to kind of figure out and wrestle with on how you're going to, forge that path forward. But yeah, I think just getting out there and experiencing it, that's what it's all about. And I think being with folks that are really passionate about these things, it's infectious.
Yes, I can pick that up. Thank you. And then one last question. Is there anything that I didn't ask that you wish I had asked? Something like something that you really wanted to be sure gets covered in this interview, and maybe we didn't ask the right question?
Oh, that's a good question.
I know I kind of spit on you, but
No, that's all right. Well, and a lot of that stuff I just kind of can fire hose you with again. But I think yeah, I think whether you become a fish biologist or not, I think there is a great deal of responsibility that's placed on all of us. And I feel like Montanans really answer this call maybe more so than other places in the country. And I think, taking an interest in what the next generation is receiving with regard to their kind of natural heritage and the resources and the condition that we leave these resources in, for those next generation, that's on all of us. It's not just a wildlife biologist job or a fish biologist job. It's really something that requires everybody to kind of see a vested interest in, making sure that we leave, a lot of the things that we really value today for future generations. A lot of the work that fish biologists do, especially with sturgeon biologists, it's not going to be realized by us. We will never see that endpoint. There are going to be biologists after us that take the torch and run with it. There are going to be biologists after them that take and run with it. And the sort of Sir Isaac Newton, I'm going to butcher the quote, but if we were able to see farther than others, it's because we are standing on the shoulders of giants. And that's really the mindset that you have to have in this position. But I think it should be the mindset that we have, as a community, as a state, that we really value these things. We value fishing and hunting, and we want to make sure that our kids, as grandkids, as grandkids, get the same opportunities that we have. And that doesn't happen by magic. You gotta, see yourself in an active role in looking out for, these critters, these places, and participate in, public common opportunities. Talk to your biologists, be a better citizen in participating in the civics aspect of, kind of wildlife and fisheries management. And I think with that, we will all see, the benefits, down the road. So I guess that's something I would add on to all this.
All right. Well, thank you. I think that probably covers it for today.
Just a little bit.
yeah, I think you gave me enough actually for a couple episodes.
Good. There
So,
you go.
yeah, fantastic. Well, I hope I get to get up there to Helena to you had a name for it. Is it just the fish hatchery there, or what is it? State hatchery or state
So this is
natural
just
hunting?
in, yeah. So this is just in the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks headquarters. And I was going to tell you, we only went through really like one, maybe two species. We've got, if we only went through one, we've got 90 more species to go through. So clear your calendar. We're just going to do Montana fish A to Z, and we'll just we'll get you covered for the rest of the year.
I just might do that. Okay, I'll let you go for now, Zach.
Thanks so much, Zach. Well, Raptor Fest is coming to Bridger Bowl October 5th through 6th. Did you know Hawkwatch International has people counting raptors as they cruise over the bridges right now? The Bridger Raptor Festival offers many exciting ways to see raptors. This event features thousands of raptors migrating along the spine of the Bridger Range. There is an opening ceremony and film in downtown Ellen on the first day, as well as events throughout the weekend. The Bridger Raptor Festival is also a great place to learn more about raptors and build nest boxes. For more information, visit the website or check out the events at the festival. You can go to BridgerRaptorFest.org for more information. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for their work on Desert Oracle Radio, to Zach Shattuck and FWP, and to the good folks at KGVM who make space for this show. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Sounds today came from the Madison River. I would love to hear from you, so please call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams. Finally, we've got a little time for some music at the end of the show today. And the first song I'm going to play you is Stan Jones himself, who was talked about in the Desert Oracle Radio episode today. And he is going to sing Riders in the Sky, which is the song that he wrote that Ken Lane talked about. And then I'm going to follow that with a song that was inspired by my camping this week. As you might have heard in my ambient sounds, my camping took place at a couple of spots at fishing access sites along the Madison River. And there were so many people there fly fishing, both from shore and going by in their drift boats and their rafts. So in honor of all those men and women and boys and girls that love fishing in our Montana rivers, here is a song from Jeff Troutman. Yes, that's his real name. From his album, Songs About Fly Fishing, 2017 was when that was released. And this song is called Heaven. So enjoy, and I'll see you next week.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw a-bowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw. Yippee-yi-yi. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves was made of steel. Their horns was black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard and he heard their mournful cry. Shirts all soaked with sweat. They're riding hard to catch that herd, but they ain't caught 'em yet. 'Cause they've got to ride forever on that range up in the sky, on horses snorting fire, as they ride on, hear their cry. Riders loped on by him, he heard one call his name. Hi-oh! If you want to save your soul from hell, a riding on our range. Then cowboy, change your ways today, or with us you will ride, a-trying to catch that devil's herd across these endless skies. Yippee-yay. 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 The ghost herd in the skies. Ghost riders in the skies.
Sun begins to shine, fog appears and then subsides, like the thoughts inside my head, all is clear. Tie on a local fly, one I've never tried, and hope and pray as it drifts by that it is all they said it be. The streets are made of gold, ivory, precious stone. So the mud and rocks they're gonna have to do. No choirs of angels here, but this river sure is clear. Oh, this is the heaven that I know. Clouds began to gather, turns in the perfect weather to be out on this river. Oh, slightly overcast, but this one will be my last. But I swear I said that a thousand casts ago. The streets are made of gold, ivory, a precious stone. So the mud and rocks they're gonna have to do. No choirs of angels here, but this river sure is clear. Oh, this is the heaven that I know.
I'm all done. The show's over.
Oh, well. That happens.